In our common vocabulary, there are a couple of different meanings of confession. We talk about a confession of faith. We really mean a kind of professing of the faith, professing of it together. The word confession, that prefix C-O-N, means together. And when we say confession, we often mean a kind of professing of the faith together. Many times that professing of the faith has been evoked out of some great struggle, or is a part of confessing the faith in some crisis or some setting that threatens the faith itself, and that threatening situation evokes a profession of our most basic conviction. So it isn't simply the kind of thing where you say, let us stand and together confess the Apostles' Creed. Rather, it's the kind of struggle that says, here we stand. We cannot do any other without forsaking the faith itself. The Augsburg Confession is a profession of the faith in this sense. It was evoked by a set of critical circumstances. In that case, circumstances critical both within the church and in imperial political life. So that one sense of the word confession, a confession of faith. When we can say confession, we also often mean a confession of sin and guilt. There's even a kind of colloquial way of putting this. If you ask someone to fess up, that means that person is to admit that he or she has done wrong. So we say confession, we may mean a confession of faith, or we may mean a confession of sin. The name, the Confessing Church in Germany, referred to confessing of the first kind, professing of faith out of a great struggle. That struggle occurred in Germany both within the church and in the nation at large, and it elicited the sharp confession of faith in what was Lutheran confessional writings is referred to as the status confessionis, that set of circumstances where everything is on the line in terms of understanding the gospel. In the name of the gospel and in faithful obedience to Jesus Christ, we profess such and such. And the Confessing Church in Germany was founded with a confession of faith of that kind. It's called the Barmen Declaration. We'll get to it in just a minute. I put it on the board. Albert Camus, writing in France in those years, had this to say, referring to the kind of situation that elicited a confession. What the world expects of Christians is that Christians speak out loud and clear, and that they should voice their condemnation in such a way that never a doubt, never the slightest doubt, could rise in the heart of the simplest man. That they should get away from abstraction and confront the blood-stained face history has taken on today. The grouping we need is a grouping of men resolved to speak out clearly and pay up personally. Well, the 30s in Germany called for that kind of confession. Speaking out clearly and a willingness to pay up personally, and the Confessing Church was in effect a kind of answer to Camus, even though there was never any official conversation. Dietrich Bonhoeffer put it in Cost of Discipleship, which was written in the 30s. He said there, when Christ calls one, he bids one come and die. So that's a meaning of confession in the term the Confessing Church. But at the same time, the second meaning of confessing our sin, pertained to that portion of the German church that resisted Nazism within the church and without. And it wasn't very long before the confessing church felt its own complicity in that which had led to, that which allowed, and that which even supported Nazism. The church, for example, had not resisted anti-Semitism in Germany before the wars.
the church in Germany had not repudiated the renowned anti-Semitism of Martin Luther, for example. And as the years went on, early 30s went on, the confessing church, professing its faith, also felt itself to be a confessing church in the sense of confessing its complicity in Nazism, even as it opposed it. And after the war, there was issued by the church in Germany declarations of guilt for its part in the barbarism that overwhelmed that nation. Two of them in particular, the Stuttgart Declaration of Guilt and the Darmstadt Declaration of Guilt. So what I'm saying then is that our common meanings of confessing pertain to the confessing church. And theologically, the confessing church in Germany lived its life between the confession of faith of the Barmen Declaration of 1934 and the Stuttgart and the Darmstadt Confessions of Sin and Guilt. We'll take those up in a bit. What I would like to do is spend about 20 minutes, maybe 25 minutes, talking about the confessing church, and then just leave it open for questions and answers and your discussion. So let me talk a bit about then that which might provide a framework for our discussion, and speak first to the church struggle and the confessing church. The term, the confessing church, does not refer to all Christians who opposed Nazi influence within the church and within the society. It refers only to some Protestants. There were Roman Catholics who resisted Nazi influence in the church and in society. They were not a part of the confessing church. This is a Protestant church. It is not all Protestants either. I suppose that the majority, the majority of Lutherans did not join the confessing church, nor did the majority of what in Germany are called Reformed, the followers of John Calvin. In this country, they're Presbyterians. Neither the majority of Lutherans nor the majority of Reformed Christians belong to the confessing church. Probably only something like 25% of the Protestants in Germany associated with the confessing church. The confessing church was one party in a struggle called the church struggle. The German term is Kirchenkampf, and you sometimes see it that way. That's why I put it on the board here. I have to explain the organizational structure of the Protestant church in Germany in order for you to see these parties in struggle. The German Protestant church is made up of regional synods. So you have the evangelical church, which evangelical is a word which encompasses Lutherans in some places and Lutherans and Reformed together in other places. But the evangelical church of Rhineland, for example, or the evangelical church of Berlin are regional synods. These regional synods are also under a national organization. So you have church offices and church bodies, both at regional level as well as congregational, and then this fellow national organization. In addition to that, the state had a set of offices. The government had a set of offices in the regions, and under the state office of church affairs. Now, in Germany in the 20s and into the 30s, the Protestant church was not a state church. There was a separation of church and state, but there were very strong ties of dependence of the church on the state. For example, the state collected the church taxes, which were then used to pay the salaries of clergy. It was just a part of the regular tax collection system. Or pastors were subject to lot of the civil service laws because their salary did come by way of the state. It's not technically a state church, but there are very strong ties. The seminaries were part of the universities, and the universities were all state universities. During the war, this becomes very important because, for example, the pastors were, as civil servants, asked to swear an oath of allegiance, not just to Germany, but to Adolf Hitler. And then that becomes a major issue in the church. Should pastors sign the oath of allegiance to Adolf Hitler, like all employees of the state had to do? Should the seminaries continue to try to operate when the Nazis took over university administration? That's another kind of question that comes up. What do you do about theological education? So I want to stress that there is the State Office of Church Affairs, which is one of the parties in the church struggle, and the church is very dependent upon, or is tied into the state apparatus, even though it's not technically a state church. The theological tone in the life of the church in the 20s now and going into the 30s, as very much like it was before, it's a very strong, what you might call, cultural Protestantism. That is to say, German citizens thought of Germany as, a phrase that was often used, Christian civilization or a Christian nation, and really felt or saw no fundamental conflict between that which was German and that which was Christian. That's what I mean by a cultural Protestantism. No basic conflict between church loyalties and state loyalties as the 30s approach. I have German friends who, when they came to this state and out of this experience of Nazism, were aghast when they walked into church with me one morning and saw the American flag to the right of the altar in one of our churches. Because for them, that was reminiscent of this kind of German cultural Protestantism, which didn't see any basic difference between the values that a good German would hold and the values that a Christian would confess. Okay, so that's the tone. Theologically, it's the tone of what technically is called Kulturprotestantismus, acculturated Protestantism. We would now call it a German civil religion sanctioned with Christian symbols. All right, now given this organizational structure that I've just defined and this general cultural Protestantism, let me describe the main parties that were engaged in this church struggle. There were the Deutsche Christen. We translate that as the German Christians. And when I use that term, I'll be referring to that party. I don't mean all Germans who were Christians. I mean a particular party that called themselves the German Christians, the Deutsche Christen. The German Christians were those who viewed the developments of the early 1930s as compatible with Christian faith, and they asked for church support of Nazi policies. Again, they were the explicators and the supporters of this German civil religion and saw in Hitler's policies in the early 30s something that Christians ought to ratify. Okay, secondly, there was a large group of Lutherans who followed the lead of the Lutheran Council, a national organization, that sought to keep matters of church separate from matters of the state and to declare a position of neutrality with respect to what the state undertook. The church had the responsibility, according to the Lutheran Council, of proclaiming the gospel in word and sacrament and carrying on the work of Christian education. The state had the responsibility of providing law and order and governance. And the church had its arena, the state has its arena, the two should not mix, and the church should be neutral in matters that belong to the arena of the state. That's the second party, the Lutheran Council and a large number of Lutherans who followed it. Third, there were some Lutherans and some Reformed, the Calvinists, who first formed what was called a confessing front or a confessing movement, and then later a confessing church, in opposition to the influence of Nazism within the church and in the society at large. Third party. The fourth party were the state church commissions out of the state office of church affairs. These state church commissions were the vehicle of the Nazi government in its contact with these other three parties and in its contact with the national church organizations. So those are the four parties, and I've put them up here. Confessing Front or Confessing Church, called the Bekennende Kirche. Bekenntnis is the German word for confession. Secondly, the Deutsche Christen or the German Christians. Third, the Lutheran Council, and that's a large number of Lutheran organizations. And fourth, the State Church Office of Church Affairs. Yeah?
Where is the Reformed Church
in
those?
Where is the Reformed Church? Yeah. In Germany, in some regions, the Reformed Church and the Lutheran Church are merged, as in what used to be Prussia, for example. And it's called a Union Church. And there is an organization, overall organization. I didn't put it up here because the people that are involved are basically Reformed people who join the Confessing Church. It should be a fifth party if you want to include everybody, and there are some other smaller ones. But it isn't nearly of the size or the significance as the Lutheran Council. Okay, now, in this church struggle, there are really three phases in the period from 33 to 45. The first phase, or the first period, is from 1933 to 1935. I want you to take note of the early date, because this church struggle will be virtually over by the time the war begins, and it pretty much passes with the world hardly taking notice, even though there were a lot of appeals in ecumenical circles to what was going on. One of the stories of shame on the part of people outside of Germany was to essentially turn a deaf ear to what people in the Confessing Church were telling the rest of the world was happening in Germany in 33, 34, 35, 36. Someone mentioned to me, I was not at the films last night, but someone mentioned to me that there was quite a difference between the newsreel that was presented from the year 1938 and its reporting of what was happening in Germany to the kind of mood that was reflected after the war began. I don't know about that firsthand, but anyway, that would be in keeping with how the outside world reacted to this. Okay, let's go to the first period here, 1933 to 35. There were a few people who viewed with alarm the rise of Hitler from the very beginning, from the time Hitler was elected in 1933. And these few Christians tangled from the very beginning with the upsurge of Nazism in the populace. Martin Niemöller and Dietrich Bonhoeffer are two names you probably know. And already in 1933, they gathered fellow clergy around them and organized what was called the Pastors' Emergency League. It was an ad hoc group, and it was simply organized to respond to what they saw was an upsurge in barbarism that was reflected in Nazi activity. I don't know what would be comparable, and I don't mean, I'm going to use some examples here just to give you an idea of the character of the organization. I don't mean to make them historical analogies, but I remember when the United States became more deeply involved in the Vietnam War in the middle 60s that some clergy and laity got together as an ad hoc group to oppose a particular policy. That was the clergy and laity concerned about Vietnam. Well, that kind of thing, just an ad hoc organization of clergy called the Pastors Emergency League, right away in 1933. Things move fast. For the first 15 months of Hitler's rule, the resistance within the church to the encroachment of Nazism took the form of a growing confessing front, not a church now, not an organization, but a movement, a front, an opposition, ad hoc opposition movement, a wave within the evangelical church contending with these other parties, German Christians, and so on. This group sought to get its members into key positions and posts, sought to influence the election of the national bishop, for example, sought to get its folks into positions of heads of departments in the national organizations, or to prevent victories by others, like the German Christians. The German Christians embraced the theology of Blut und Boden, people and soil, right away, and there was this struggle. In 1934, in May, those who identified themselves as confessing Christians gathered in a little town in Germany called Barmen, and they came from these various regional synods that I mentioned, and at Barmen they declared their faith. They said, our situation is one in which we must profess our faith together in opposition to what is happening in the church and the country, and the outcome of that was the founding document of what would become the Confessing Church. That document is the Barmen Declaration, 6 theses. Here we stand. The single most influential author was a young Swiss theologian teaching in Germany at that time. His name was Karl Barth. He would soon be banished from Germany by the Nazi government, something that the state could legally do because Barth was a professor at a German university. That is to say, he was a civil servant. And so the state could say, okay, your employment is terminated and you must leave the country. He was a state employee. It was at Barmen in May 1934 that the term confessing church was first used. Incidentally, just a few weeks ago in South Africa, that term was broached for the first time in their situation, in a synod of black South African Christians. They are now talking in South Africa about whether or not a confessing church is needed in the struggle around apartheid. If you want a good account of what's going on there, read John DeGroote's book, The Church Struggle in South Africa. John DeGroote is himself presently the moderator of the Congregational Church of South Africa. He's also scholar of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and he knows exactly what's going on there in terms of its analogies to what happened in Germany. There are very strong similarities between what's going on in the church in South Africa right now and what happened in Germany in the 30s. Okay, Barmen, 1934 then, the first time there's talk of the confessing church. 6 months after Barmen, in October 1934, the Dahlem Confessional Synod was held. Again, these opposition Christians from around the country came together to a special meeting. And it's at this point already that the Confessing Church is established. It didn't declare itself a new denomination. It didn't say, like, it wasn't a schism like the AELC from the Missouri Synod or something like that. It wasn't quite that yet, an alternative denomination. But what it did do was start down that road in a major way. It said, for example, that confessing church Christians did not owe allegiance to the national bishop, the head bishop. And it began setting up what it called emergency organizations, parallel organizations to carry on church life, parallel to the establishment organizations. I think of a kind of example in our own recent history. When I was teaching in college in the late 60s, and on many campuses there would be these assemblies, community assemblies, and they would challenge the authority of, say, the student council or the university administration or whatever, and would start talking about having their own alternative institution for campus considerations. Okay, that very same kind of thing happened with the Barman Synod. Started setting up emergency parallel organizations. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, for example, was teaching at the University of Berlin. He would teach his regular classes, and then a group of dissenting and confessing church students would meet with Bonhoeffer, and they'd go into and have a different class, and they'd discuss the events of the day, so on. So this is the sort of thing that was happening. Later on, the church will move from Barman Confessional Synod into being a full-scale alternative church, and it will set up, for example, its own set of seminaries rather than using the state universities, though they were illegal. They were underground seminaries. Let me quickly add, there are two events happened between Barman, May 34, and Dahlem, October 34. In August 1934, Hitler combined in his own person the two highest offices of the land, the Führer, the leader, and the Reich Chancellor. What that meant was that Nazi power had consolidated itself. Let me read to you this paragraph of a letter by Dietrich Bonhoeffer to Reinhold Niebuhr from June. From middle of July 1934. In June, Hitler carried out a bloody purge of the military, and that was a signal to a lot of people that Nazi power was consolidating itself. And then in August, Hitler occupied both the two highest offices of the land. He'd only had one before. Referring to this bloody purge, Bonhoeffer writes to Niebuhr, "The most recent events in Germany have now shown beyond a doubt where we are headed. I am only astonished that no Protestant pastors were among those shot on the 30th of June. In our circles, it's becoming increasingly clear, particularly after the recent muzzling of Frick, that the time of the Kulturkampf has arrived, the time where it's a struggle for culture itself, our civilization has arrived. It's curious seeing how long it takes before a Protestant clergyman even considers that possible. Also, they wish to know far less about these things in Westphalia than, for example, we in Berlin. People just don't want to know what's happening. The danger of an Orthodox so-called intact church is very great in Germany, and I consider it very possible that one day the state will actually find its best ally in this form of church." What Bonhoeffer means is the danger is that the church will seek to keep itself intact, remain a single organization, maintain its unity, which is what the state actually wants it to do. It does not want the confessing church going a separate direction. An Orthodox, intact church is certainly a more secure guarantee for the Nazi state than Mueller's church. Now, Mueller is a national bishop who was elected in 1934. It was a victory for the German Christians. Bonhoeffer is saying that the state would like no waves from the church, and that actually that would be better for the Nazis than to have even a German Christian church. "With all the pressure for an orthodoxy of this sort, we'll have to guard against this danger in particular. Many of us are very short-sighted here. A man such as Mueller, the new national bishop, would not shy from subscribing to our entire orthodoxy, and perhaps even more or less honestly, measured subjectively. The dividing line, however, lies elsewhere, namely with the Sermon on the Mount." Bonhoeffer is writing The Cost of Discipleship. "Now the time has come when the Sermon on the Mount must be brought to mind again on the basis of a partially restored Reformation theology, although to be sure with a different understanding of the Sermon than the Reformation's. And precisely at this point the present opposition will divide again. Before we reach that juncture, everything is only preparation. The new church which must come about in Germany will look very different from the present confessing church. Opposition at that time The Confessing Church has not gone far enough and is trying to take a more radical one, and the real danger is that the church will remain intact. Okay. And Hitler's consolidated power in August. In September 1934, Ludwig Müller, openly favored by Hitler in church elections that were supposed to be free of any government comment, Ludwig Müller was consecrated as a new national bishop, Hitler's man. That was a victory for German Christians, those folks supportive of Hitler's policies and supportive of surging German nationalism. The Confessing Movement Church Christians begin talking about the Church of Germany as a brown church, meaning that the Nazi chauvinism of the brown church was showing up in the church. And if you had been to any of the great church rallies at the Olympic Stadium in Berlin or somewhere else in the country, that the Deutsche Christen, the German Christians, planned and carried out at those times, you would have known what that meant, the brown church. Great celebrations of people and soil. Blut und Boden. The kind of the thing that when I see that, and I've seen documentaries of those rallies, old film footage, the only thing that I can think of that comes close to it is a kind of Ku Klux Klan atmosphere. That kind of feeling about them. Overall, from 1933 to 1935, what we have is a transition from a confessional front or opposition movement to an organized opposition body called the Confessional Church. As even until the end of this period, though, 1935, the confessing Christians hoped that they would have success within the larger national church. They wanted to steer the whole church in a different direction. So they're really a reformist movement till that period. Our time is going quickly, and I do want time for discussion of the lessons and the issues. So let me move to the next two phases. 1935 to 1937 and the Confessing Church. Ludwig Müller, the new national bishop, Hitler's man, was really a bumbling fool. I mean, even the German Christians who had supported him soon turned away. He was just ham-handed about everything. He botched everything that he undertook. He was replaced by a fellow at the level of the state office of church affairs by the name of Wilhelm Zollner. Wilhelm was a respected churchman. He was a Lutheran. He took that job as the state office of church affairs in the hope that he could bring unity to the church. The Lutheran Council, the Confessing Church, the German Christians were still active, and he thought he could still get them together. The Confessing Church, because it respected Zollner so, placed some limited hope in him in doing this. At the same time, however, the struggle between Nazism and the church intensified so that a lot of confessing church members found themselves in jail, or the confessing church drafted a memorandum on the Jewish question, or as it was often called, the Jewish problem, and sent it to Hitler. And said, in effect, that the command that Jews were our neighbors and the command to love one's neighbor had to prevail over the officially inspired hatred of the Jew. So that there's an intensification of the struggle on the one hand, and on the other hand, there's some limited hope placed by the Confessing Church in Zollner to bring the church together. It was during this time that the Confessing Church becomes increasingly an alternative institution. This is during this period that it sets up its illegal seminaries, for example. There were lots of bans. People couldn't publish, couldn't speak in public, and so on. Lots of arrests, although most of the time when the church brought the cases to court, they won. Um, this period then, from 35 to 37, the Confessing Church is not so much a reforming movement as it is increasingly an alternative church. And Bonhoeffer was one of those who thought as such. And you often have rather radical statements. Bonhoeffer said during this period, in Germany, outside the Confessing Church, there is no salvation. Either you belong to that or you're outside the faith. All the rest is heresy. This is, of course, the meaning of Dante's Confessione. Yes, Mary?
Well, some estimates are. There wasn't anywhere in Norwich, for sure.
Was it full congregations, like
yeah.
The pastor, like the ADLC? Good
question. It varied from place to place. Sometimes it was just a group of folks within a congregation, with or without the pastor. Other times, the whole congregation would become a confessing church congregation. And then there would be these networks set up by way of, they were called the Brüderrat, the Council of the Brethren, to in parishes which were geographical locations. Many congregations occupied one parish. And then the confessing church would have its own alternative organization within that. But it varied from individual house church kinds of things to congregations.
But
you know.
Was it an underground church from the beginning?
No, it was not. And it's in this period that it's increasingly becomes an alternative institution. It's not yet underground. It's public. It's parties within the church, or a party. It's in the next period, from 1937 to 1945, that it moves from a kind of marketplace, public, above-ground meeting of opposition, what we call opposition Christians, opposition to Gnosticism. It becomes, moves from that increasingly to a catacomb kind of existence. After Zollner resigned, Zollner finally said the church, the state is demanding too much of the church. And even though he tried, he said we cannot have the unity of the church on the terms that the office of church affairs of the state requires it. He resigned. His place was taken by a lawyer by the name of Friedrich Werner. What Friedrich Werner really sought was the isolation of the confessing church. And Werner was really a tool in the hands of the Nazi government to suppress opposition to government in church quarters. So the church struggle from 37 to 45 really is no longer so much a struggle within the churches as it was until that time, as it is now a struggle between the confessing church and the state. And it's a struggle for the survival of the confessing church. For example, the Gestapo shut down those illegal seminaries in 1940. The book that Bonhoeffer wrote, that some of you know, Life Together, is the book of recollections of what their community life was governed by and like in the illegal seminary that Bonhoeffer ran and that the Gestapo shut down in 1940. Niemöller has been in Dachau for some years already. A lot of Christians were in prison, and basically there is this shift of the confessing church from a public institution of resistance in the marketplace to a catacomb existence. They still met in synods, still met occasionally in public, and it shifts back and forth, and it's different from one region to another. That's another thing one has to know. Sometimes they would meet, have their regional synod in a different part of the country than the region from which they came, because so many of the Christians were banned in that particular region. So the people in Berlin would have their meeting in some other part of the country where those folks could go and speak in public because they were banned in Berlin. So that kind of thing happened as well. Basically, it's a case of trying to survive as a confessing movement. When the seminaries were closed by the Gestapo, sometimes a teacher and a group of seminary students would form what was called a collective pastorate, and they would do theological education on the move They would spend some time here and work in confessing church congregations, and then they would move along and spend some more time there doing their education on the way. That's what happened to the group at Finkenwalde, the seminary that Bonhoeffer was head of. The Nazi regime was effective through those years in progressing dissent. And then the war itself brought great dissension within the confessing church itself. This takes some explanation. I don't have the time to do it right now, but you can imagine what kind of feelings there were in the confessing church once the war began. Should confessing church Christians support the war effort or not? And many of them did, and they were conscripted into, they were drafted, and they went. About two-thirds of the seminary students in Bonhoeffer's seminary, which is one of six of the confessing church, died on the front. And these were those who were the opponents of Nazism. But a lot of them said, we are not fighting for Hitler, we are, however, fighting for Germany. And however, other elements of the confessing church did not support the war. Karl Barth, that author of the Barman Declaration, sent a letter in 1938 when the Nazis marched into Czechoslovakia, sent a letter to Joseph Romatka, and he said in this letter, every Czech soldier who fights and suffers will be doing so for us too, and I say this unreservedly. He will be fighting for the Church of Jesus Christ, which in the atmosphere of Hitler and Mussolini must become the victim of either ridicule or extermination. Well, that letter of Karl Barth to Hermanica saying that the Czechs who resist the Germans are fighting for the Church of Jesus Christ, that was caused a storm in the confessing church in Germany. There was great dissension, and one of the great issues of the confessing church is the whole question of military service and whether one ought to what civil obligations one has to the state. Okay, I think we better sort of stop here with one last note. I want to say something about the confessing church as really the only public institution in Germany during the Nazi era that was identified as a public institution of opposition to the Nazi government. Hitler decimated the socialist and communist labor unions as soon as he came to power. The concentration camps were built for them first, and then it's a little bit later that the Jewish policy of the government. But the concentration camps were built by Hitler for German communists and socialists. He simply decimated their labor unions. So the labor unions were not the place of opposition to Nazism. The state universities were taken over relatively early by Nazi administration and were never the place of organized public resistance. It was only the confessing church in all of Germany that was a publicly identifiable institution. For that reason, lots of people who were not Christians were drawn to the confessing church, and you had a curious kind of dynamic. At the very time that the confessing church says only Jesus Christ is Lord, and Jesus was a Jew, and there is no salvation anywhere in Germany outside the confessing church. At the same time as those radically exclusivist claims were made, people of sensitive conscience who did not even call themselves Christians anymore were drawn to the confessing church. And there's an interesting passage in Bonhoeffer's Ethics where he uses two New Testament verses, two sayings of Jesus. Jesus says in Mark at one point, he is not with us, is against us. He says in Matthew, or maybe I've got to turn around, he was not against us, he was for us. And one of us, that's exactly the dynamic that's happening now. And that's because the confessing church was the only visible dissenting body.
All right. I've got a list of sort of lessons and issues, but let me ask first whether there are comments or questions. The time goes easily by. Well, it's the 40s where the death camp.
In the early 40s.
Yeah, so and then right up to the end. On that, yeah. Nick?
How did all this affect the character of the church following? What happened?
Yeah. Both of those are matters of issues I was going to address, so let me pick it up there. Let me take this first question, subject of the Jews, because the confessing church and the Jews is, that whole story is an agonized and in many ways, I think, a shameful one. Now let me share evaluations of the issues and the lessons provided by confessing church members themselves looking back. I'm trying to pass along their evaluation, not simply my own. And with respect to the Jews, the confessing church made some statements, like the one I cited earlier, in solidarity with the Jews. But basically, the confessing church did far too little, far too late. And at first, the confessing church people said, well, anti-Semitism is a Nazi problem, a Nazi perversion. After the war, there's been a reevaluation of that whole thing, and confessing church members now, looking back, say something like, it's Western Christianity that has been anti-Semitic, and it was in our Christian faith, and we carried it into the war and through the war. And, for example, their real concern over Jews during the war, most of their energies on that whole question were for Christian Jews. I could read to you something that is such an example of this. The strongest statement about the Jews from the confessing church. Let's see if I can find it here. Came in 1935, going into 36. It's a memorandum prepared after the Augsburg Synod of the Confessing Church and before the next synod, which is at Steglitz. It's entitled On the Position of German Non-Aryans. Okay? It says this. Where is Abel, your brother? In our case, too, in the case of the Confessing Church, there can be no answer other than that given by Cain. And if the church, afraid for her own destruction, can in many instances do nothing, why is she not at least conscious of her guilt, do nothing about German non-Aryans, the Jews? We're Cain and Abel, we're brothers. Why does she not pray for those who are afflicted by this undeserved suffering and persecution? The persecution of the Jews is already taking place, not the death camps yet, but persecution. Why are there no services of intercession as there were for their imprisoned pastors? The church makes it desperately hard for anyone to defend her, but that there can be people in the confessing church who dare assume that they are entitled, even called, to preach to the Jews whose present sufferings are our crime is a fact that must fill us with icy fear. Since when has the evildoer had the right to pass off his evil deed as the will of God? Let us take care that we do not conceal the horror of our sins in the sanctuary of God's will. Otherwise, it could well be that we too will receive the punishment of those who desecrated the temple, that we too must bear the curse of him who made the scourge and drove them out. In other words, it's a strong solidarity. Why are we not having prayers or intercession for the Jews? This is our crime that we are not speaking out, doing things. At the same time, you heard the end of that, it identifies the Jews as those who have been cursed by God. This anti-Semitism is still there. The theology was that New Israel kind of replaced Old Israel. Now the church replaces Israel in God's covenant and so on. Okay, so the confessing church really felt that its treatment of the Jews was was part of the Holocaust itself. Now, after the war, Rick, to your question, it depends on what area you ask. It depends what area you ask that about. In terms of church organization, the church in Germany went back essentially to the kind of organization that it had before the war. The tax system is still used. Universities as part of the state, and seminaries as part of the universities, although there are some separate seminaries as well. Structurally, it's very much as before. This was a big debate after the war between those who wanted something different and members of the Confessing Church itself, like Otto de Bailius, one of the leading Lutheran bishops, that wanted a restoration of what was called the Volkskirche, the church of the people, the whole people. So, but it structurally it went back to that, essentially. Let me say something about the church and further resistance. The church, the Confessing Church, fought for survival through the 40s, and the organized resistance essentially shifted to clandestine resistance located elsewhere. The opposition to Hitler and Nazism took place essentially in the military and was part of a military and political resistance from within the Nazi machine itself, and no longer in the church. And the heritage of German Lutheranism was such that when the shift of resistance went to the military and political circles, such as Dietrich Bonhoeffer and friends around him, the church itself sought some distance from that. And so Bonhoeffer's name, for example, did not appear after he was arrested on the list of people that Confessing Church Christians were to pray for, because it was found out that he was involved in some, been arrested for something other than carrying out the work of the church. As to say, at that point, the church had its own equivocation about resistance itself. It's a long story, but it goes back to a Lutheran theology that did not have a theological ground for resisting an unjust state, and it even shows up to the end. Bonhoeffer himself said, in a letter to his friend, I would consider resigning my ordination in the Confessing Church as a part of this involvement. It's an equivocation. And one of the issues that comes out of the war years, as the Confessing Church members look back now, is a whole Lutheran theology of what constitutes proper civil obedience and what constitutes civil disobedience, and what are the theological underpinnings for that. Yes. The Lutheran ethic that was used by the German Christians, Deutsche Christen, this faction, was an ethic of the, in Lutheran theology it's called the orders of creation. And it says all of us are born into human communities that are already formed. So we have family, we have nation, we have economic life, etc. These orders of creation have their own God-given sets of responsibilities and duties in them. And that's how we know what it is Christian to do. God provides for order in life through the ordering of these human communities. Okay, the German Christian said, this is what we're born into. We have this nation, we have these responsibilities to government, the responsibilities to family. That's the way creation is put together. And they bolstered Nazi doctrines of belonging to a people and a country in those terms. The Confessing Church at the same time proclaimed gave focus to Jesus as Lord and said, no, you must follow Christ in the radical command of the gospel that is expressed, for example, in the Sermon on the Mount. Well, the Lutherans have said the kingdom, there is, in the Lutheran two-kingdom doctrine is one which talks about the kingdom of Christ on the one hand and the kingdom of God on the other hand, said God rules both. And even in the confessing church, never quite got it straightened out back and forth there. And that's one of the things that needs overhauling. Well, I'm sorry we came up short, but so it is.